Radiotopia.
I'm excited to tell you that one of our favorite Radiotopia siblings, Ear Hustle, is back with a new season. Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast. Co-hosts Nigel Poor and Erlon Woods have recently been spending time at four California prisons and have a season's worth of funny, surprising, and unforgettable stories to share. In a recent episode, they were able to visit a groundbreaking prison hospice where they spoke to men who are grappling with the reality of dying inside prison. Also coming up this season are stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells, complicated mom-daughter relationships in prison, and incarcerated people who wonder whether they've become too comfortable behind bars. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it. Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts. This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Dear Diary.
Sixth grade.
February 14th.
1991.
I am really depressed.
How could she break up with me?
Mom, you can't read this.
You're listening to the Mortified Podcast. I'm Neil. And today, because we love Mom so, so much, we present the second installment of our two-part Mother's Day series. Last episode, we met a woman with more than one mom. And now we're introducing you to two very different kinds of mama's boys as we explore what it's like for boys raised in homes where mom rules the roost. One, strict. And the other, well, we'll let Mike explain.
It's like, don't pamper your kids. Love them, sure, and all that, but like they have to go make mistakes and figure out how to get out of the mistake on their own.
That's Oscar-nominated writer and director Mike Mills.
If I dyed my hair, if I did anything outrageous, if I ran away, my mom would be like, how was that for you? It's pretty wildly child faith-based, whatever you want to call it. Like, that's a hell of a lot of trust in this new soul.
While Mike never chronicled his teenage years in a diary, his latest film, 20th Century Women, is essentially just that.
Do you think you're happy? Like, as happy as you thought you'd be when you were my age.
Seriously? You don't ask people questions like that.
You're my mom.
Especially your mom. Look, wondering if you're happy, it's a great shortcut to just being depressed. Give me that.
And watching the film in the run-up to Mother's Day, we were struck by the parent-child dynamic, a painfully honest portrait of what it's like to be raised by a mom whose parenting style was at times absurd. So we just had to know if it was real.
So this is in the movie a bit, like, my mom didn't do this for me, but she did it for my sister. My sister was skipping school all the time. And the school called her in and said, like, look, your daughter can't just skip school. And my mom's like, why not? She finds school boring. You know, like, my mom was like that. And they said, well, you have to write notes. My mom's like, really? I'm saying this is okay. Like, no, it's like the rules. So my mom just wrote these crazy ass notes like my sister broke her leg or my sister had brain surgery, whatever.
Please excuse Jamie from school this morning. He was doing volunteer work for the Sandinistas. Please excuse Jamie from school this morning. He was involved in a small plane accident. Fortunately, he was not hurt.
She's super funny and ironic and sarcastic and anti-authoritarian. A super strong sort of proto-feminist, born in the 20s, you know, Amelia Earhart type figure, right? But she's definitely a tougher mom than I think any mom I know.
Annette Bening was nominated for an Academy Award for playing a fictionalized version of Mike's mom. But we soon found out his real-life mom was even more eccentric. Her tough love approach was so extreme at times, and put Mike in some pretty ridiculous situations, and from a very young age.
So when I was little, really little, fourth grade, she said, I'm going to give you an allowance, but it's a big one. It was like $20 a week or something like that. She goes, but you have to pay for everything. That is not like food at home. Like anything to do with school, your clothes, you have to keep track and you're gonna have an account. Go. So of course I went and bought all the G.I. Joes I could possibly buy. And then I had to buy, you know, something came up and I was like, crap, I have to mow so many lawns or whatever it was to make the money. And she just enjoyed the hell out of that.
And Mike's mom wasn't just letting her son make his own mistakes. She was daring him to.
I was a junior in high school and my mom goes, so this summer you're gonna live out of the house. You need to move out and get a, you know, your job at McDonald's maybe and get more hours so you can pay rent and food, and you just need to learn how to like live. So I got an apartment with a guy in my band who was older who worked at a liquor store who was kind of a mushroom dealer on the side. And we lived in one room together separated by a flag. Like it was like really run down. And I worked at McDonald's all the time. She thought that was great.
Being raised by a mother that's actively challenging you to grow up can teach you about the ways of the world quickly. But it can also feel like flying a plane without the manual. Frustrating, and at times, frightening. Especially when expressing those fears and frustrations isn't a part of the training.
She had a darkness, a sadness, a unresolved stuff that she just couldn't speak about or look at all. That's the mind fuck, you know? There's a lot of depression in my house. You know, for my parents, that's undiagnosed, untalked about, and super illegal to even like say you see, right? So it's even just saying like, hey, mom, I see you're sad, and any form of that, it could just be a look, that's illegal, right? So you're living in this very underground railroad situation where you can't say the elephant in the room over and over and over.
Feelings aside, Mike's unorthodox upbringing did teach him how to be self-sufficient and proactive, which is mostly a good thing. Except when he was searching for ways to release all that pent-up angst.
This is really a sign of some of the untouched, unhelped sadness and confusion, right, that we're all feeling. So we would get drunk, like four or five of us, drive around in the hills of Santa Barbara, so it's like curvy roads, with someone on the roof, like hanging onto the luggage rack, and we're trying to get them off the roof in the car, like swerving. So it's one time we're driving a convertible, that seems so much safer, but that's the night that I flip out of the car. My friends don't even realize I've fallen out of the car because everyone's so loaded. 5 minutes later, they realize Mike's not in the car. I'm just passed out in the street, unconscious. My pants are broken and I have a scar from my head all the way down my back to my butt, you know, like a road rash. And I peed my pants and I'm trying to figure out how all this has happened. And then it's August, and then I start to get really sad because it's, in my mind, it's Christmas time and I didn't get them any presents, and I start crying because of that. And that's when they take me to the hospital, but they just do the thing of leaving me in front of the emergency, you know? I finally call my parents, and my mom's, it's like 3 a.m, and my mom's reaction is, are you okay? And I'm like, I'm fine. I do have a concussion, they want me to stay here. And my mom goes, all right, we'll see how that feels. We'll see you in the morning, you know, and that's that.
It seems like there was no way for Mike to do the one thing most teenagers need to do, rebel, unleash his angst until he inevitably triggered his parents. Luckily, there was one scene that came about in the 70s that catered to kids like Mike.
I was in a punk band. We had a song called Preppies Make Me Ill. Preppies Make Me Sick. You know, it was like that. Preppy makes me ill, preppy makes me sick, preppies make me ill, barf, barf, barf. Repeat, yeah. So punk is amazing in that way. It's like, oh, I'm angry, I'm sad, I'm unhappy, I'm all these things. Like you have a mirror and a voice and a helper to help you figure out, oh, I feel that. That's this thing that I was never able to point to.
And so, what did Mike's Depression-era mom think of the raucous music he and his friends used to express their unbridled emotions?
My parents wanted to come see my band play at all of our shows. They would get dressed up, and they would sit through the whole set and then want to discuss it afterwards, you know? My mom didn't get it. My mom wasn't super into it, but she got that it was important to me, tried to take it seriously, wanted to talk to me about it, kind of like in the movie. And I find that to be love, you know, and to just watch and be there, presence. Presence is love.
So, sweetie, I don't know if we ever figure our lives out. And the people who help you, they might not be who you thought or wanted. They might just be the people who show up.
While Mike Mills' mother didn't believe in things like training wheels, Zach Sherwin's mom couldn't even bear the thought of her son getting in the slightest of scrape-ups.
I used to get mad because she would force me to wear my helmet when I was rollerblading, and I would ride down the street, and then as soon as I was out of sight, I would hide it in a field and go rollerblade without it. My mom and I were, you know, always close, and she was always very, very proud of me, very supportive, made that extremely clear. I knew that I was loved, and she would always tell me how smart I was and how good I was. So yeah, she was a very, like, loving mother. One might even say, like, doting.
And all that doting had a purpose. After all, since Zach was a toddler, it was just him and his mom.
After my dad left, we didn't have any contact. It's as simple as that. No visits, no phone calls. We didn't exchange correspondence. I would get updates sometimes from my uncle about him, but mental health issues have kept him out of the picture.
In his father's absence, Zach and his mom became a team. Everyone saw them that way, even at the local synagogue, where Zach's mom was the rabbi.
My friend's dad used to call me Rabbi Boy, and, you know, I was. I was like a little mascot. My mom liked it when I went to Friday night services, so I would go, and all these, like, middle-aged and old people would, like, ask me questions, and I would respond politely. But yeah, I did feel like I was kind of, like, representing the brand. My mom's rabbi brand.
But as puberty approached, Rabbi Boy was not how Zach wanted to be known anymore. So he set out to create a new, more macho persona.
I was not a particularly athletic kid. And in high school, I did activities like concert choir and French club. So, like, manhood and masculine identity were very important for me. And I, you know, I craved father figures and male role models. But I did have some important, like, masculine figures in my life. When I was 10 years old, I discovered gangsta rap, and I was sort of hooked from there. The first rap video that I ever saw was the Naughty by Nature video for OPP. And I saw it, and it just instantly sucked me in. Tretch, the lead rapper from Naughty by Nature, and the other rappers that I saw were so tough and manly and dangerous seeming, which was everything that I wasn't. And so I really gravitated towards it. It's probably the first time I encountered emotions being expressed so strongly, like negative emotions in this particular way. Like it's an angry gangster rap record. You know, it's like pretty hardcore. The cover is them standing on like a pile of rocks in East Orange, New Jersey, where they're from. And Tretch is like holding a machete. The music I'd been brought up on was Raffy and Free to Be You and Me and the Beatles, like the kind of stuff my mom was listening to in the 60s and 70s. To my mom's credit, she really trusted me and gave me enough rope. Pretty soon I started writing my own rap lyrics. I might have looked like a dorky Jewish kid, but on the pages of these notebooks that I would fill up, I was on some very thugged out shit. And so what I'm going to read you tonight are some rap verses that I wrote between the ages of about, like, 13 to 17. So here we go. I'm dropping mad rap lines like the barbell after your last rep. I'm repping till the last gasp. I grasp your throat and tear your septum. Rectums get kicked by the cipher I flip with, and MCs get beaten down by the same fist I grip with. I grab a hold of mics and don't stop the hip hop. Got my rhymes in order, 1, 2, 3, 4, like quartets at barbershops. So call the cops, a bumper crop of hard rocks. Just got slain after testing this. Blood drop stained spots like chicken pox. Like crock pots. I've been heating for a long time, so feel the simmer. Glimmer and glitz means shit to me. I'm indecipherable. You can't calculate my molarity. High school chem. Or unravel my mental puzzles. I'll fuck around with your polarity. Reverse the laws of nature. Revoke the rules of physics. When I alter the state of rap using an unbreakable hieroglyphic. Egyptian codes with a curse like Tutankhamun. I'm bombing with Mike rhymes that tap rappers' noodles like ramen. Eponymous self-titled debut swings like liquid swords. Makes you suicide like stressed out Japanese entrepreneurs.
I think the rhythm of that is great. Like, thumbs up, younger self. When I think back on it, it's like I knew that my friends, they knew on some level that it was like made up braggadocio and totally not the case. And so I feel affectionately towards that little guy, but it's embarrassing because you're saying this really, really graphic stuff and you're like a child.
Okay, so of course, I wasn't living this kind of lifestyle when I was this age, but writing about violence and feeling tough in this way was like something that other guys my age accepted. And pretty soon I had a little group of friends that I would make up raps with. And so this next rhyme is one that I wrote in collaboration with my friend Kyle Bell, who rapped under the name Yardy K. Because he would rap in a dancehall reggae patois, and Yard is a nickname for Jamaica. You know who this is. It's fucking Zach the Rip. And if you try to step up, I'm soon unloading the clip. Because I'm the crazy pimp with my brother Yardy K. We've been rhyming, chart climbing since back in the day. So if you want to try to step up and get fresh, I got a crazy crew and you'll be taking your last breath. So come follow me, come follow me, come follow me, come follow me, come. I'll be ripping breathtaking rhymes off the end of my silver tongue. But that's enough of that shit. It's time for me to switch up the mic to my right-hand man, Yardy K. Rock this joint, Jamaican homie, in the Rasta way. So needless to say, Yardy K was also white. But the fact that we were both white did not stop us from once performing at our almost entirely white high school's Black Awareness Assembly. It was a disastrous performance. I tried and failed to freestyle in Hebrew.
Oh, I'm sure people laughed at us for, you know, wanting to be black. I'm sure it was weird for the black students at our school to have us rapping in the Black Awareness Assembly. I don't know. It was off my radar. I was pretty oblivious to it. I just thought it's cool that Kyle and I rap and people must like it and think it's good. Listening to rap and writing rap was a place where I could let my hair down a little bit from being Rabbi Boy and just be this other person who gave less of a fuck.
And so I kept writing rhymes and carving out my place as a man. And in this next verse that I want to read for you guys, you can feel me like staking out my masculine territory. And so this next verse is called, I Represent What? I represent what? My nuts, son, my balls. I should say that at the time I wrote this, I had had neither sex nor oral sex. So this is conjecture. They're what draw the hoes close when I'm sending out the booty calls. Fellas, shake your hips. Come on, let them swing. They're not only my homies, they're like a couch for my ding-a-ling. Or, less like a couch and more like a shelf. I adore them, I represent for them, because they can't do it their damn self. They don't have mouths or brains, and that's a problem. But yo, it's all good when your mouth comes and gobbles them. I represent what? My nuts, son, my genitals. There's two of them. They're brothers like the motherfucking chemicals. So I filled up a few of these rap notebooks with raps like these. But after a while, even I knew that it wasn't an accurate reflection of who I was. And so I kind of stopped doing it. And I went off to college and moved on with my life. So my sophomore year of college, and a friend of mine across town at Tufts, who knew that I was into hip-hop, got a hold of me, and she was like, there's like a back-to-school like fall concert at Tufts, and there's a rap act headlining it, Naughty by Nature. The group that got me into rap in the first place. So I went to the concert, and like two-thirds of the way through the concert, they're like, okay, Tufts, every show we do, we like to let local talent come up on stage and do their thing. And they're like, you know who your best MCs are, send them on up. And we were right up in the front, and my friend sticks my hand up in the air, and Vin Rock, the second fiddle guy, points at me, and he's like, yeah, you, Kid Rock, because I'm white. And KG, their DJ, the guy who made the OPP beat, points at me and scratches in a beat. And I started rapping a verse that I had written, and it went amazing. I destroyed. It went so great that in this article that appeared in the next issue of the Tufts Daily, Fall Fest rocks the house. It says, the most impressive rhyme was a student who seamlessly wove a couplet with rhetoric and hydrochloric. I mean, you want to... Beatboxer? Who's that MC up in the motherfucking hizzy? Cause when I rock the microphone, I'm known for getting busy, man. And I'm hip-hop and proud, yo. Shouts to avocado-ass underground MCs from caves and grottos. Despite the fact that I came up in the burrs, I'm jigga-jigga with verbs, metaphors, and all types of words. Herbs on alter my mind state up. I wreck the state up 8 days a weekend. You know I wreck all 8 up. And MCs on mics never lasted long. Either they passed it on or got blasted on by the master on the kid who's so old school. They call me prehistoric. Who's the man? Yo, that rhetorical question burns like hydrochloric. Thank you. There's more, but we can cut there. Thank you, man. Beautiful. Thanks. So I killed that verse, and then Tretch, my hero, comes up and puts his arm around me in like a fatherly embrace. And he was wearing a bulletproof vest. And I can feel it pressing up against my old Navy t-shirt. And it felt so good. And so that night I went home and I listened through to Naughty by Nature, their self-titled debut album, all the way through. It had OPP on there, but it also has a song called Ghetto Bastard, which includes Tretch saying, I was one who never had and always mad, never knew my dad. Thank you, guys.
So Zach found his way as a kid, just like Mike Mills had, through music. And rapping is actually something Zach still does today. And not just in his spare time, but for a living.
Okay, stop. Wait. Please hold up. Deeply sorry to interrupt. I'm also Zach Sherwin, but not the one from the last verse. I'm a more mature version, and I want to say to myself, okay, that drop bar thing is a cute wordplay, but I gotta take a critical dig at this drivel. It's trivial and frivolous.
And according to Zach, none of that would have been possible if his mother had tried to discourage him in the first place.
There's a book called The Phantom Tollbooth that I liked when I was a kid. And before the kid goes on the quest, this wizard says to him, there's one thing that I have to tell you, but I can't tell you until you come back from the quest. and then it's left alone for the whole book. And then he comes back, quest complete. And the wizard says to him, the thing that I had to tell you was, it's impossible. And the kid says, what? And he's like, there's no way you can come back alive from this quest. And the kid's like, but here we are. And the wizard says, if I told you before, it would have come true. But the fact that you didn't know until now means that you were able to complete your quest. And so sometimes I think about that and I'm like, if anyone had said to me at the time, don't do this, I wouldn't have. But because I was so oblivious, for better or for worse, you know, here it is.
Check out Zach Sherwin's latest rhymes at zacksherwin.com. Also, thanks to Mike Mills for joining us. I'm a huge fan of his films. If you haven't seen them, I highly recommend checking them out. To share the shame, follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, or visit getmortified.com to learn about Mortified stage shows, books, films, and beyond. Click participate, and who knows, maybe you'll appear on a future episode of the series. As many of you know, the Mortified podcast is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, which is made possible with support from the Knight Foundation. Thanks to AdZerk for providing their ad-serving platform to Radiotopia. And if your company would like to support our podcast too, that would be great. Email sponsor at radiotopia.fm. Our podcast production team for this episode includes Hadley Dion, Shelby L. Otmani, Dave Nailberg, and myself, Neil Catcher. Music by Gordon Bash, Alex Burke, Adam Smith, The Angel, Zoe Rose Palladino, and Snake, Snake, Snakes. Stories were produced for the stage by Karen Corday and Sarah Faith Alterman. Big thanks to Lance Roberts Studios and all the dedicated Mortified Live producers whose work make the stage show possible. Until next time, we remind you that we are freaks, we are fragile, and we all survived.